From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Emily Tamkin, foreign affairs reporter for BuzzFeed News, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is West Wing Report's Paul Brandes, also a USA Today columnist.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. Results continue to come in from the recent midterm election here in the United States, and it's mostly good news for the Democrats. President Trump went to France to mark the end of World War I and, as he often does, stirred up controversy. The investigation into alleged collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign has taken some new turns. We'll update you on that. And Facebook, the social media giant, likes it when people share things, but perhaps it doesn't want shared info about what it's been doing behind closed doors. Well, let's start with this midterm election here in the United States. In last week's program, you heard about how the Democrats took the House of Representatives and how Republicans added to their hold on the Senate. But in the past week, there have been these additional results that have continued to kind of dribble in. And Tom, it's mostly been good news for the Democrats. Bring us up to date.
That's right. At the moment, there are about 6 to 8 to 10 races in the House that have not been called. They're razor-thin margins. But at the moment, the Democrats have picked up a net gain of 35 seats, which is enough for them to take over the House on January 3rd of next year, which is going to be problematic for President Trump. And the estimates are that when all the votes in these handful of outstanding races are counted, the Democrats will have a net gain of between 38 and 39, maybe if they sweep the table, 41. Either way, regardless, this is the House is a real problem for President Trump. There's also a recount in Florida. I mean, Florida is always central. Many of our listeners will remember the historic recounts in Florida in 2000 where George W. Bush became president by a margin of 537 disputed votes and a one-vote margin in the Supreme Court, which ruled in his favor 5-4. So Florida is always a mess. At the moment, the Republican candidate for governor and for senator are ahead. And the courts have gotten involved. There are manual recounts being ordered. Nothing at this moment has been certified, but it appeared to me that the Republicans would take both the governor's race and the Senate race. But it could be days before we know for sure.
And, you know, Emily, these Republicans kind of poo-pooed the election results last week, saying, well, there was no wave election after all. But 41 seats, as Tom said, would actually be the biggest Democratic gain, I think, since 1974 after Watergate. And in percentage terms, it's actually bigger than the wave election, for example, of 2010. This was actually a bigger deal for Democrats than people think.
Absolutely. It was a wave. It just one that hit the shore very, very slowly, right, over the course of a week rather than Tuesday night, one and done. I think Tom's exactly right in that the House is or can be, depending on how Democrats play it come January, a big problem for President Trump, both because Democrats have shown that suburban voters and particularly suburban women are turning from his particular version of the Republican message. And second, because even with one chamber, right, even with just the House and not the Senate, Democrats can still do some damage to Trump's agenda. They still have oversight. You can't, for example, appropriate money to the Pentagon without the House's say-so. You can't get your trade agreement passed if the House isn't on board. So we will see how the Democrats in the House decide to play this, or even if they come out of this with a united platform, which it's not clear, right, that the Democrats have one Democratic message. But yes, this was a significant win for the Democrats with significant consequences to be shown come January.
So this divided government now with the Democrats in charge of the House and Republicans in the Senate, we've had divided government a million times in this country. But what's going to happen over the next 2 years with that kind of dynamic in place, you think?
I think you're going to see a very frustrated White House, right? Because President Trump was frustrated with what he couldn't do with both houses of Congress, right? And now he's lost the House. I think that House Democrats are going to try to be a check on what Trump is trying to do, which is how the system was supposed to be set up, right? You know, these people talk about, oh, the framers intended. The framers did want a legislative check on the executive and vice versa. But I think in this particular political context, you're going to see Democrats try to show their might and muscle, one, because they don't agree with what Trump is doing, and two, because they're doing it with an eye toward 2020.
Too early to talk about implications for 2020, Tom?
No, I don't think so. I think the implications began the morning after the November 6th elections. Even before the election, President Trump had been told, we're going to lose the House, focus on the Senate. And he did that. And I think depending on how the Florida Senate race comes out, the Republicans will pick up at least one and probably two in the Senate, which is important for appointments, especially Supreme Court appointments and judicial appointments. So that's the good news for President Trump. But the bad news, as Emily was talking about, is manifold. For one thing, the House will be run by the Democrats, which means they can decide what bill goes to the floor and what bill gets sent to Siberia. Also, investigative oversight. Every committee and subcommittee of the House will be run by a Democrat who will have subpoena power, so they can go look at whatever they want to do there. And so I think there are implications for 2020. But even before the election, when Trump was told, we're going to lose the House, Trump had a comeback. He was telling friends, this will be a blessing in disguise. President Trump told one of his friends, in a paraphrase, it could be worse, because the Democrats will be my foil. I can use them as a foil, and they overreach. They'll make it bad for themselves and good for me, because that's what they usually do when they get power. They mess it up. But his power has been diminished significantly.
So he's in for a frustrating 2 years.
Right, but he thinks he can turn the Democrats against one another. And he thinks somehow he can blame the Democrats for everything that doesn't happen well in the next 2 years.
Well,
their fault, not my fault.
Well, he might be able to do that.
Well, that's certainly the game plan going in.
Well, moving on, World War I ended 100 years ago, and world leaders gathered in Paris recently to mark the occasion. President Trump was among them. And Emily, for President Trump, didn't go too smoothly for him. What happened?
What didn't happen in terms of President Trump's trip to France? No. First of all, shortly before he arrived, President Trump became aware of comments that Macron had made that he interpreted to say that there was going to be a European army.
The French president.
Exactly. Right. French President Emmanuel Macron had made that seemed to suggest that there would be a European army to counter the United States, which is not what the French president said. He was speaking about, he does think there should be a European army and greater European defense, but the specific comments about the United States were about a cyber threat that could come from within the United States and how Europe should be prepared to defend that. Never mind. Trump took this to mean you're trying to muster European might against the United States. And don't you remember when we defended you from the Germans in World War II and et cetera, et cetera. Macron was not able to talk him out of this when they met, apparently. And then, you know, Trump was supposed to make a trip to a cemetery, didn't go because of the weather. Reports say that he was disappointed that there wasn't the same sort of military parade that he had seen the last time he was in Paris. It was, I think, politics aside, this was supposed to be an event commemorating the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War. And it really, at least for Americans, became about this show that our president was putting on, the starring role of which was a feud with the French, right? And this was sort of not the time or place for that, given the historical importance and context of this day.
And he always seems to make it about himself, Tom. And the thing is, when he's in Europe, I mean, poll after poll in Europe shows a low approval for President Trump. And I mean, really low in some places. I mean, single digits, I think, like in Germany. How is the North Atlantic alliance between the U.S. and Europe, which has been around since the end of World War II, how is that holding up?
Well, it's holding up barely, I think. I mean, I think the base is strong, but I mean, I think the Europeans have let it be known that they're worried about Trump's constant call about them doing more. And I don't think NATO is going to collapse. But I think what Europeans consider to be Trump's combative tone towards them, as opposed to a friendlier, much friendlier tone towards Vladimir Putin, has set the Europeans on edge. So there's a lot of tension. And I think the Europeans will be paying a little more for defense than they have, which is one of Trump's primary objectives. But I think there's a real credibility schism here. There's not a lot of trust between European leaders and the Trump White House, and that cannot be a good development.
You know, Emily, this whole thing about NATO countries paying more for their own defense, I mean, they are paying more now. Trump takes credit for that. But if you look at the data, I mean, I'm asking you because you're a foreign affairs reporter, their spending actually began to go up in 2014, I think, after the annexation of Crimea. In other words, this predated Trump, didn't it?
It did predate Trump. I will say that European defense officials have said that they've found it useful, Trump's sort of bluster, because they can then go to their governments and say, no, really, we need more money for defense. But on this note, I would just like to note that Macron was calling on Europe to do exactly what Trump has been telling them to do, which is take more responsibility and spend more for their own defense. European leaders in touting PESCO, right, which is their kind of European Union defense coordination, have stressed that this was meant to supplement NATO. Macron's European Intervention Initiative, right, which is supposed to be 9 European countries that would take on missions that NATO didn't necessarily want to, for example, in Mali, is one of his kind of examples for how this European army, quote unquote, might be useful. You know, it is meant to take some of the military burden off of the United States, which is what Trump has said that he wants. And his reaction to Macron's statement, right, to a European president who said, okay, you want us to spend more on defense? You want us to take more defense responsibility? Here we go. His sort of saying, well, no, I meant that you need to pay NATO, which is, first of all, not how NATO works. But second of all, it kind of suggests that what Trump is calling on is not actually Europe to take defense more seriously, but to have America dictate how Europe spends its money, which suggests that Trump's every country needs to be concerned about its own sovereignty is actually not true, right? That what he's actually calling for is for every country to listen specifically to him. And I think this is what goes down so poorly in Europe.
All right. Let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
You're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download a podcast of the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Also, you can visit the program on Facebook and leave a comment or two while you're there. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel, and don't forget to like us. Now back to our panel. Emily Tamkin, foreign affairs reporter for BuzzFeed News, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and USA Today.
Welcome back. We were talking before the break about Europe and President Trump and Russia. Well, Matthew Whitaker, the acting attorney general, has said he will not recuse himself from the investigation into alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. That's why the earlier Attorney General Jeff Sessions was fired. Now, Whitaker, Tom, seems to be quite close to the president. What does that mean for this investigation?
It's problematic for the investigation. Whitaker has a kind of a checkered career as a prosecutor and a businessman, but somebody brought Whitaker's musings on cable television to the president's attention over the last couple of years, where he has taken a very hard line on the Mueller probe. Whitaker alleged there was no collusion. So now he's the acting attorney general. It seems pretty clear he was brought in to exercise some authority over Mueller. So the question becomes, will Mueller be able to finish his investigation? Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona, who will be retiring at the end of December, and has been a perennial critic of the president, is threatening to put a hold on all judicial appointments between now and the end of the year unless the Senate takes up this bill, bipartisan bill, protecting Mueller against being removed. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell objected. It wasn't brought to the floor. And so you have this situation where a lot of Republicans are worried that Trump is going to make a move on Mueller through his acting attorney general, Mr. Whitaker. But Trump and his allies are saying Trump has no intention of firing Mueller. I think there would be a firestorm in the country if that were to happen. So Whitaker puts pressure on Mueller. The other thing is, you can be sure that anything Mueller, as a courtesy, is telling Whitaker is now going right back to the White House. And so when you see an angry tweet from the president saying these prosecutors are yelling and screaming and threatening witnesses, I'm sure Whitaker is telling him that based on what people who have been called before the Mueller grand jury have said. It's not a good development for Mueller, but it's kind of inconceivable that Trump would either fire him or allow him to be fired, given the current climate. On the other hand, I think the president has been on edge about Mueller for over a year, and he's particularly on edge these days because things didn't go so well in the elections or in Europe. And I think that's just thrown the president off stride, and he's kind of lashing out more than he usually does.
And the thing that always amazes me, Emily, is that if Trump says, well, there's no collusion, there's nothing to see here, we've done nothing wrong, well, then why even fear the investigation if you've done nothing wrong? Why not let it play out and let Mueller and everybody else kind of make fools of themselves if nothing wrong was done?
One would think, if you know that you didn't do anything wrong, right, one would think that the most effective way of dealing with this would be to allow the investigation to run its course, not let them find anything, right? Maybe a Manafort here or a whoever there is kind of, or a Michael Cohen there is picked up along the way in the course of Mueller's investigations or New York investigations or what have you, but they won't get him himself, right? Now, maybe it's just that he's frustrated that this has been going on so long and that he feels it's a distraction from I don't know what, but you're right. It's sort of odd that the president would keep bringing attention to the Mueller investigation if he's so frustrated by it.
I mean, he's acting like something's wrong, but he claims there's nothing wrong.
Right. You know, one of the things I learned as a very young reporter covering Watergate, actually, I learned two things. One is the cover-up, if there is a cover-up, is always worse than the alleged crime. But the other one is, from damage control standpoint, if you don't have anything to hide, don't behave like you do.
Right.
And the Trump administration is behaving like there's something out there that they don't want anybody to know about. And that kind of keeps everything going here.
And he calls this a witch hunt. But there have been, as Emily just said, there have been a whole bunch of people who close to him who have been convicted or pled guilty, who are looking at the long stretches in prison. I mean, who? Michael Cohen and former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn, and on and on and on. These are people who were extremely close to the president, been friends of his for decades.
I believe that there are going to be some new indictments coming in the next handful of weeks, and some of these indictments will be against comrades of President Trump since long before he was president, as well as people who worked for him in the early days of this government.
Now, we were talking a minute ago about, you know, the Democrats have the House now. They could get their hands on Trump's tax returns, theoretically, which everybody thinks could be really reveal so much more about possible dealings with the Russians and their allegations of money laundering and things like that. Can they actually get his tax returns?
Yes, they can. There is a law or a regulation somewhere that the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee can receive a president's tax returns if requested. And I'm sure that will happen one way or the other, although I suspect if the Democrats request his tax returns, the White House will immediately appeal and it'll be tied up for who knows how long and will ultimately go to the Supreme Court. And I think President Trump is counting that with Justice Kavanaugh being confirmed for the court, that there's a solid conservative majority. I think you're going to see a lot of litigation on a lot of things the Democrats want in the next 2 years, and there'll be any number of things that'll find their way to the Supreme Court where President Trump is hoping he will get a favorable ruling.
So they might not actually get the tax return.
Well, I think they're going to ask for them, but I don't think, after spending his entire presidency resisting these tax returns, at some point, I think it's unreasonable to suspect that President Trump will say, okay, the Democrats won, here are the tax returns. I think they're very damaging politically for him.
Okay. Well, finally, there was a blockbuster report in the New York Times recently that says Facebook, we're talking about the big social media giant, of course, and it's left the company with a really big black eye in terms of what it's been doing behind closed doors to protect its image, and there's also some revelations, Emily, about what it knew about Russian interference in the 2016 election. What did Facebook know, and when did they know it?
Earlier than they pretended to know. But I think the main takeaway that I got from this report was how unseriously Facebook is taking its fake news problem. And I don't mean fake news in the way that the president uses it. I mean information that is not true, that populates on Facebook, that people then take as their media source. The fact that Facebook was using Affirm to say that critics of Facebook were paid for by billionaire George Soros, which is an anti-Semitic trope, and also saying that criticism of Facebook was anti-Semitic, that to me suggests that despite all of the hand-wringing and all of Zuckerberg's, you know, coming before Congress and all of the, oh, we're so sorry statements, that actually Facebook is not grappling with its role in the 2016 election. It is not grappling with its fake news problem today. And we need to stop looking to Facebook itself to solve the Facebook problem.
When you talk about Democratic investigations, now that they have the House of Representatives back, I think there's going to be a huge investigation into Facebook. The incoming Democratic chairman of a House antitrust subcommittee has already said Facebook cannot police itself. They have to be regulated. And so I think there's going to be a huge investigation. It will make Zuckerberg and his deputy, Sheryl Sandberg, very uncomfortable. I suspect there are going to be some senior officials at Facebook who will have to be jettisoned. And I think there will be a strong attempt to bring more government regulation to what Facebook does for a living. They're looking at several years of a lot of problems.
What about this Cambridge Analytica? This is the kind of the data analytics firm that's been linked to Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. They were working with Facebook on some level, too. What's that all about?
Well, partly they were using this group to help in damage control. And one of the things they were doing was opposition research. Basically, they were trying to discredit the critics of Facebook. And the fact that there are this particular group does have a connection with the president's son-in-law, those are not the kind of headlines you're going to want to see. So this Facebook, as I said earlier, is going to be under a lot more pressure than they have ever been. And I think their reputation is going to continue to be damaged, because I think Emily is absolutely right. What they're focusing on most is how to contain the damage, not how to fix the problem.
And since you said it's not too early to talk about 2020, if they were Facebook problems in 2016, are we going to see these again in 2020? And if so, what, if anything, can be done about it?
I have no reason to believe we're not going to see it again in 2020. We've seen it all over the world since the 2016 election, including very recently in Brazil, right? Like, Facebook's failure to take itself seriously as a media company, which has media ethics and which has some responsibility for what it puts out and pushes out on people's feeds, that failure has affected elections all around the world. And maybe you want to say, well, it's not the main reason why certain people are winning and others are losing, but it's a factor. And it's a factor that we didn't really have before that people now need to consider. Do I think that Facebook is going to make some huge change in the next 2 years? No, I don't. Do I think that Tom is right and that we're going to see Congress try to pressure Facebook? Yes, I do.
I mean, they have 2 billion users, I think, around the world. I mean, that's far bigger than any other media organization you can, at least I can name, right?
Yes, and what Zuckerberg has been trying to make lately is we have so many people, 10,000 all around the world, that it's really hard to get a handle on what everybody is doing all the time, which is probably fair enough, but it doesn't absolve you of the responsibility of trying to clean up the mess in your own house. And Facebook has come to that process very late in the game. They find themselves with the worst image in the history of their company.
All right. We'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to Tom DeFrank. He's contributing editor for National Journal, and Emily Tamkin. She's a foreign affairs reporter for BuzzFeed. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer Joe Gill. And I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thank you for joining us.